Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Can an ID proponent be an atheist? I'm Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast, interviewing Professor Bradley Montan, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado Boulder. Professor Montan, we've had you on for a couple podcasts recently, and I'm really pleased to have you on again and continue our conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
So, Professor Montan, in the last two podcasts, I think you answered that question for us. But if you wouldn't mind starting us off with maybe, again, addressing that question. And I'd like to talk about maybe some of your recent work on intelligent design. And you gave a talk recently on ID. And I'd like to hear some about what happened at that talk.
Sure. So I'm an atheist in the sense I don't believe in God, but I'm not certain that God doesn't exist. I'm interested in exploring what evidence there is for the existence of God. The reason I'm an atheist, by the way, is that I just don't see enough evidence there for the existence of God, and I'm not going to believe in God in the absence of evidence. But I do see some evidence there, and one reason I'm so interested in the intelligent design debate is that the intelligent design proponents are looking for evidence for the existence of God, or at least some sort of designer. And specifically, I'm excited that they're looking for science-based evidence. And I think that's a legitimate activity to engage in. And I think that there is some evidence there. Now, where is the evidence coming from? The intelligence design proponents tend to focus on evolution-based arguments for the existence of God. They tend to focus on, for example, Behe's irreducible complexity argument. And I think that here I'm going to offer a little bit of a criticism of intelligent design proponents. Sometimes they portray intelligent design as being just about evolution. And I think that that's a mistake. I think that there are other science-based arguments for the existence of God or some sort of designer that have nothing to do with evolution. And those arguments are worth taking seriously, too. And I'll tell you about what I think those arguments are in a second, but let me just make a preliminary point, which is, let's suppose that those arguments were right. Let's suppose that we did get science-based evidence for the existence of God or some sort of designer. That might lead us then to question the standard neo-Darwinian naturalistic account of evolution, even though we didn't get direct evidence against the standard naturalistic neo-Darwinian account. Because we got the evidence through other ways for a designer, then we could go back and look with new eyes, shed new light on maybe what's going on the evolution side. And here's a hypothetical way in which this could happen, as a way of illustrating my point. Suppose that we didn't get any direct evidence for the existence of God or some sort of designer when we investigated evolution. But when we investigated physics, when we started looking at the physical world, you know, the sorts of things that physicists look at, we did get evidence for a designer. We did get evidence that, you know, a designer was involved in being involved in physics. Well, that could, in principle, influence how we understand evolution. For example, right now, no one knows what the source of high-energy cosmic rays are, or ultra-high-energy cosmic rays. They're these cosmic rays that come from space that impact Earth. And one of the things these ultra-high-energy cosmic rays do is cause mutation. And that's part of how you know the evolutionary process happens, is you have mutations plus natural selection, right? Suppose it turns out that in investigating physics, we discover that these ultra-high-energy cosmic rays have an unexpected source. You know, maybe we could get evidence that the source is supernatural, or we could get evidence that the source is super intelligent aliens or what have you, right? So that's a way that, in principle, one could get evidence for the existence of a designer, and then that, use that evidence as evidence that actually the evolutionary processes are in part being designed, not just on unguided natural selection, without having any of the standard evolutionary arguments that the intelligent design proponents tend to give being successful. Now, I'm not saying that that's at all a plausible scenario, but I'm just saying that that should, in principle, lead one to think, oh, you know, there are other arguments that one could investigate besides standard irreducible complexity type argument.
I think that people often get so caught up with ID and biology that they forget that the ID and cosmology argument is very strong and has a very long tradition within the ID community. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, I mean, when you use the phrase ID community, you could just be talking about the Discovery Institute type community, or you could be talking about, you know, the whole history of philosophy, where people are giving, philosophers are giving teleological arguments or design-based arguments for God. That has a long history going
back
to Plato.
No, and that's actually what I'm talking about. Right. I mean, I think I always find it amusing that people claim that ID is repackaged Christian theology, given that non-Christians have been making these arguments for over 2,000 years. But you're absolutely right, Professor Montan. I know that you recently gave a talk where you expressed some of these arguments and some of these views that you have about ID. Was it at the University of Colorado Boulder?
Yes, there was a public lecture. There were about 240 people there.
Oh, wow. Can you share about the reception that you received?
Sure. It's interesting in that some of my colleagues, who I'm treating as the neutral, objective observers of this because they don't have a bone to pick in this debate, they thought that I said a number of things that would make Christians unhappy or theists unhappy, but they were surprised when I told them that all the negative reaction I got from people during the talk and after the talk and emails was from the atheist side of things. Hmm. And all the Christians and, you know, people on that side of things appreciated my intellectual honesty and were sympathetic and going to hang out with Doug Grotius, who's a professor at Denver Seminary soon. So I'm getting to know those people. And obviously, you know, I have profound disagreements with them, and they know I have profound disagreements with them, but they appreciate my intellectual honesty in dealing with these issues. And some of the people on the other side weren't so happy. For example, well, during my talk, people were shouting out, "That's not true," and things like that, which is especially annoying because I'd asked them at the beginning to save questions for the end. But I think it sort of shows how emotional some people get about these issues. And the people who were shouting out, they were clearly on the atheist side of things. One could tell. That was sort of frustrating for me, that they get so emotional and aren't dealing with these issues dispassionately. Apparently a biology professor told one of my colleagues after the talk, he said, "Is Brad Montan the next Ward Churchill of the philosophy department?" And, you know, Ward Churchill is this reviled former CU professor who was academically dishonest and also said, you know, offensive things about the World Trade Center victims and was fired for his academic dishonesty. That's sort of chilling, actually, to have a fellow professor in my university call me the next Ward Churchill of the philosophy department.
I can imagine. I mean, he was dismissed for plagiarism was one of the things he was guilty of. Yeah. So almost the sense that I'm getting is that simply because you espouse these views, that therefore you are intellectually dishonest. That's kind of what they're hinting at.
Yeah. And it's you know, the interesting thing about it is all of my philosophy colleagues I've talked to, who are totally willing to disagree with me on all sorts of issues, and we do disagree on all sorts of issues, thought my talk was great and thought I did such a good job presenting issues and thought I, you know, gave good arguments. Even when the cases where they disagreed with me were sorts of minor issues where we disagreed. They weren't going around saying, "Oh my God, this guy needs to be fired for intellectual dishonesty."
You are tenured, I believe you said. Is that correct?
I do have tenure. I was talking to Dembski a few months ago about these issues, and he said, "You know, you need to be prepared for getting attacked within academia." And I said, "Oh, I'm not worried. I have tenure. My philosophy colleagues all appreciate what I'm doing." But I hadn't thought of some biology professor getting mad at me and making a crusade out of it. I mean, hopefully that's not going to happen, but certainly the chilling effects are disappointing.
I hope that you don't experience what many others have experienced, Professor Montan. You're a very nice guy, and a lot of people in the ID movement are nice people, and it pains me to see the persecution, to see the attacks. The comparisons to Ward Churchill, that's just what they're saying, but that is not all that's going on. People don't make those comparisons without having some motive to actually act upon them, especially people in those kind of environments. We shouldn't just say that that's mere harmless banter when biology professors are comparing a person who's an ID proponent to a professor that got fired for intellectual dishonesty. I want to say that I hope for your sake and for the sake of all those who just care about intellectual freedom and truth, no matter what their view is on ID, just that you don't experience any of that kind of stuff. So
the great thing is that I think that there is a silent majority who, within the philosophy, academic philosophy community at least, who would be on my side. Obviously, there are some of the most vocal people like aren't, you know, but I think that most people would be like, okay, you know, these arguments have a long historical tradition, one can take a stance on them, one can disagree. You know, maybe the vocal minority will cause problems, but I do think that within the philosophy community at least, most people think these issues are worth talking about dispassionately. Or at least they wouldn't criticize a colleague who did think the issues were worth talking about dispassionately for talking about them.
Were there any other chilling effects that you experienced after you gave this talk?
The one I wanted to tell you about actually isn't after I gave this talk, but it's just one that has so perturbed me for so long that I haven't talked about it publicly until now. And I'm going to talk about it publicly in my book, but you're getting a sort of precursor to it. We talked about my paper about the Dover case, which I posted online, and which is going to be reprinted in my forthcoming book. And one of the responses I got to my paper was from Robert Pennock, who I criticized in a roundabout way in my paper, mostly because I was criticizing Judge Jones, and Penick's testimony influenced what Judge Jones had to say. Penick sent me an email calling my paper defamatory and telling me that I had to pull it off the internet by the end of, you know, he gave me some particular date by which I had to pull it off, and saying that I had to email CC the request to pull it off the internet to him because it was posted on a Philosophy of Science archive. And it really was a sort of legalistic threat, using this term defamatory and telling me what I had to do. It was chilling, and it really disturbed me that a fellow academic would behave that way.
Wow, that is incredible. I assume that given that you're going to be publishing this, that you didn't give in.
No, I did not pull it off the internet. And I sent him a conciliatory email in response, and he never wrote back. And I sort of, I don't think I should have been as conciliatory as I was, because the more I think about it, the more offended I am that he behaved that way towards me.
You certainly called his bluff, and I'm glad to hear that he was bluffing. And before we go any further, I want to take this time to just plug your forthcoming book really quick. Can you remind us of the title and when it's going to be coming out?
So the title, unless we make last-minute changes, the title is going to be Seeking God in Science, An Atheist Defends Intelligent Design. And it's probably coming out in summer 2009, and it's being published by Broadview Press, which is an academic press that also markets to non-academics. The book is written in such a way that, you know, an intelligent non-academic would totally enjoy reading the book.
Well, this sounds very exciting, and I want to congratulate you, Professor Montan, on this. I'm sure that your book will be a hot seller in this issue, and we'll definitely want to have you back on when the book comes out. Professor Montan, thank you once again.
Thank you.
Go check out his website, bradleymontan.com, and be sure to check out his book, which is coming out next summer with Broadview Press. The title is Seeking God in Science, An Atheist Defends Intelligent Design. In the meantime, stay tuned to the ID the Future podcast for more updates. This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast, signing off.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.